It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have we Americans forgotten why and what we're working for? That's a question at the heart of a new book by Benjamin Honeycutt of the University of Iowa. It's called Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. It's an account of evolving thought about work, leisure, and progress in American history. And Benjamin Honeycutt joins me in the studio today. Hello.
Hello, Ben. Good to see you again.
Good to have you on our program again. You are a historian, a professor of leisure studies, also at the University of Iowa. We want to talk about our attitudes towards work and leisure and a very interesting historical look you have, a sort of a debate, a struggle, if you will, of why we work, how much we work, and how much time we have to ourselves to pursue other things. But start us off by telling us about what you believe is a forgotten American dream that we as a society have, to a large extent, it's clear, have left behind.
Not only a dream, but a reality. The thing that brought me to the dream part was a very real process in American history. For over 100 years, you've heard me say this before, Ben, I've been working on this for a long time, over 40 years, which I consider one of the great mysteries of the modern age. The working hours were gradually but steadily reduced for over 100 years, what I've called the century of shorter hours, from 1820 through the 1920s. No one expected the process to end, indeed the very, very opposite. People like John Maynard Keynes, the most famous economist of the 20th century, Eric Severide in your business, I'm sure you'll remember, the broadcaster, all predicted confidently that before the century's end, the 20th century's end, we'd be working about 2.5 hours a day based on what had been happening in American history.
And there were some very serious people worried about what we would do with all our free time.
Severide among them. He thought that I think this was 1972, on a broadcast talking about the problems ahead for the nation. This was in the Cold War and so forth, and he said the big problem, the biggest problem, would be an adjustment to the fact that there'd be less work for us to do. Unemployment, of course, a great problem we still face. But at the time, unemployment and short hours were two sides of the same coin.
And you make the point in your book that what was driving this was an idea of progress that we don't necessarily, all of us, latch on to today. The progress was to use what work as a means, not right. as an end, which many of us see it as today.
Exactly. And the idea that work is the center of life unalterably, now and forevermore, and that work is an end in itself is new. I think it dates back to the no earlier than the 20th century. I think during the 1920s and 30s, this new belief system was solidified politically with Roosevelt's administration. Before that, the American dream was two parts. Certainly work hard, make a living. That was highly valued and still is, of course. But work was not an end in itself. Work was had a destination, get enough, take care of business, get all the wood in, all of the chores done. Then that would be an opportunity to live. And as machines were perfected, as technology advanced, and we would have more and more machines to do our work for us, then we would have more opportunity to live our lives freely outside of the marketplace, to do the thing for itself, family. Community. Walt Whitman, my favorite writer from the 19th century, perhaps from American history, talked about higher progress precisely in these terms.
Mm-hmm. So that's the term that you use in this book is higher progress, that we are all evolving as a society and we want to work, thrive, but at the same time, what was this extra time to be used for?
It was a sort of an open arena. There was no one idea about what the freedom would result in. As I say to my classes, it's leisure's question. What is worthwhile in it for itself? And there are a myriad of answers. it kept unfolding as I went back further and further from, I started with the Great Depression in the 1920s, which I think is pivotal, and then I worked my way backward, and it was just really fascinating. The reason I've stayed with the project is because it has unfolded for me in a very surprise that I didn't expect it. I kept working backwards through Whitman, through William Ellery Channing, backward. I finally got to the colonial period, which really surprised me, with the New Light Puritans, of all things, Jonathan Edwards, which amazed me. And he has that vision that we'll use our machines, our technology. He's a child of the Enlightenment. He's not an old-fashioned, straight-laced Puritan, you know. Mm-hmm. He's a New Light guy. We'll use our machines to free us. And he talked about the kingdom of God. He had a religious – his answer to what are we going to do all this time was, from his perspective, of course, religion, the things that have to do with the community of saints, of believers. One of my favorite of his examples, he wrote during a period called the Great Awakening, and he described this process where the people were so enthusiastic about their religion, about their faith. They stopped working, and it frightened him. He got several of his sermons. You've got to work. You've got to take care of business. But he gives a whole list, a catalog of things that he thought we in the kingdom, as Christ's kingdom would come, we would be more able to live our lives together. And my favorite example, let me do this one, I love it so much, is he quotes one of the women in the choir, singing the choir at the church downtown. And he quoted her as saying, she would like nothing better than to sit and sing this life away. a beautiful quote. Indeed, this is again, the list is long.
Right. You name many names, prominent names from our early history in this country. None more prominent than Ben Franklin. I copied down a quote, if I may read that and have you comment on it, because we certainly know Ben Franklin not only as a founding father, but a long-lived man and a very productive man. He wrote, the quote you have in your book is, if every man and woman would work for 4 hours each day on something useful, that labor would produce sufficient to procure all necessaries and comforts of life, want and misery would be banished out of the world, and the rest of the 24 hours might be leisure and happiness.
Exactly. The pursuit of happiness. Thomas Jefferson's phrase, he had in mind something like that, something of this progression, the progress of freedom, the progress of freedom politically. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Of course, that term expands. But that idea that we would be able to pursue our freedom politically so that all of us, women, minorities, all of us, are able to have these basic political rights. And then economic, a free market, wonderful free market, pursue our own advantage, take care of business, and then the third level is higher progress for Benjamin Franklin.
How mainstream is this thought? We know that these thoughts existed. We have Benjamin Franklin here saying it. You have many people quoting it. But I guess there's a difference between having a view of progress, one view of progress, and having the dominant view of progress.
Right. I'm not able to find our view of progress until the 20th century. The idea that work would be reinvented anew, perpetually, and that we would follow more and more needs, that needs would multiply indefinitely and forever, and work would follow. That idea is not in the 19th century that I can find, and I've done this a long time. Our idea that the economy is going to expand forever and that work will be manufactured in that process of expansion so that we'll have full-time jobs, that's new. Mm-hmm. I'm not able to find that back in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. You said the 1920s were pivotal.
Right.
What made the 20s pivotal?
A couple of things. The economy was reaching a point of maturity in a lot of ways. Food, clothing, and shelter, the basics, were being met more and more efficiently. The culminating process of work hours, the process of work hours, I should say, culminates in the five-day week during the 1920s. And so people became very concerned with the future. What's going to happen next? The leisure was coming. And the realization, the threat of leisure. Some business people wrote books about the threat of leisure during the 1920s, that people will leave the marketplace. Henry Ford wrote about to pursue Gandhiism, which is the way Henry Ford described it. We'd live our lives, you know, spiritual stuff and all that, you know, hokum. putting time in with our families and our children. You know, well, that sort of threat was
that was looming. Looked down upon
by a lot of people in not only the business community but a lot of people. And this, I think, is the beginning of that our new view is that fear that leisure free time is overtaking work by some parts of the population. There was this concern
and making us a less great nation. Did we have this global competitiveness at this time, or did we just think of our identity differently?
All of that, but even more. There were a lot of points of view. Why is this leisure dangerous? From the likes of Sigmund Freud, who writes about the future of illusion, he thinks without the discipline of full-time work, we would be free, human beings would be free, and that freedom would mean the release of all kinds of base instincts in order to keep ourselves under control in all sorts of ways. We have to have full-time work. And if we're not driven to work by starvation, then we have to have illusions prepared for us by our culture to convince us to keep working for no other reason than to keep us under control. If these baser instincts were to be the idle hands of the devil's workshop, that's always been a strain in our culture. But it comes out aggressively during the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. And so we have the Depression, and then we have the Roosevelt administration, which you say is a key here to this change in mindset too.
Exactly. Well, it follows the 1920s. The business response to the 1920s, the new economic gospel of consumption, the birth of advertising, the new belief system that we could be convinced to buy new goods and services that we've never seen before and never heard of before, rather than taking the time off to spend with our families or whatever, buy those things automatically. That's a new idea, that we can be convinced by advertising and by marketing to consume things we've never seen before. That's the business opinion of the 1920s, and then Roosevelt's administration. These sorts of ideas become codified in law and public policy.
Mm-hmm. And so take us then post through World War II up into the present. How have we evolved since then?
Well, so let's do Roosevelt. Roosevelt sets in place during the Great Depression. Unemployment is the problem, of course. Everyone knows that. But as Henry Ford put it, a lot of other people understood it the same way. Free time is a natural result of economic progress. Ford, this is a quote from Ford, free time will come. The only choice is unemployment or leisure. That we could have, you know, we've got to deal with the fact that machines take work. That capitalism, God bless it, its major function is to kill jobs. It is to make us more efficient, sell products cheaper. If you can get a machine that will replace the 20 workers, and you can make a product that's cheaper and better in some cases. So that is a natural, not a bad result. But the response is very important. And the original response to the Great Depression was work sharing.
Okay, we're going to talk about that when we come back. We have to take a short break. We'll pick it up with work sharing. My guest this hour is Benjamin Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies, a historian at the University of Iowa. He's worked at this for over 40 years, unraveling what he calls this mystery of U.S. labor history and how at one point we were working towards shorter working hours, shorter working weeks, and then it reversed itself. So where are we now? We're going to pick up with that in just a moment. Back, fascinating conversation. Ben Honeycutt's latest book is called Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, Benjamin Honeycutt of the University of Iowa. His latest book, Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. He's talking about the fact that in the early 20th century, there was strong support for shorter hours, a shorter hours movement. Working hours were essentially cut in half as people began to embrace the possibilities of a life beyond everyday work. But then that trend towards shorter working hours ends, and we're up to around the Second World War. We ended by talking about work share.
Work sharing with the Roosevelt administration, I think, is pivotal. It was the original response to the Great Depression. Republicans and Democrats alike supported the idea of work sharing. There was a bill in Congress, a 30-hour bill, that came within a hair's breadth of being passed. I can tell my class it's a sort of a razor's edge in history. If that bill had passed, perhaps we'd see a different reality. It didn't. Suffice it to say, Roosevelt came up with a new plan. His idea was the new economic gospel of consumption. The government will step in whenever the unemployment reaches a certain level and do all those things that we are very familiar with these days, stimulus spending, deficit spending, the growth of government. The growth of government, in my opinion, is largely due to the fact that we have such a large government and it continues to grow that scares a lot of people. The reason we do have the government that we do is to provide full-time jobs for people that need them. Full-time, full employment is defined for the first time with Roosevelt's administration. Before Roosevelt, full-time job was a sliding scale. It was not 40 hours a week. It got shorter and shorter. Roosevelt pegs full-time job at 40 hours. Anything less was unemployment or sharing the unemployment of a part-time job. He says we've got to stop this process. In effect, politically, he says this. And the government then steps in with all of its stimulus, all of its public works, all of the things that we're very familiar with that Obama has recently done, that George Bush did, that Reagan did. It's bipartisan. The government is the guarantor of full-time, full employment. That is why short hours stops, is that government steps into to a free market process that saw higher wages and short hours for over 100 years. This, to me, is the original government intervention into the marketplace.
So are you saying that this is the beginning of an assumption, because we all take the 40-hour week for granted or full employment mm-hmm. for granted, an assumption that we have to question?
It didn't come from down the mountain from with Moses, the Ten Commandments. The 40-hour week is a historical accident. And it's an accident that comes out of Roosevelt's administration.
So this is fascinating. You just called it the 40-hour work week an accident.
Yes.
So as a historian, having studied all of the American history in terms of labor, the struggle between labor and leisure and all the other things, the idea of progress, we could have been what today if this accident, as you call it, not happened? What is an alternative universe you, Ben Honeycutt, and me, Ben Kiefer, could have been living in?
Exactly. That we could have lived out the original American dream, where we would progress not only with more goods and services, absolutely. Progress takes two forms before Roosevelt's administration, higher wages and shorter hours. Since then, of course, we've lost sight of shorter hours. Yes, it can change again. I tell my class that this is not something that 40-hour week is not something that is necessarily permanent, and probably will change in their lifetime. The idea that we can continue Roosevelt's great campaign, his great project, a full-time full employment forever and ever. I can't believe that. I believe some things that are hard to believe. I say in church about the resurrection of the body and so forth. Hard for me to struggle to. But that to me is a piece of cake compared to the belief that the economy will grow forever and ever, enough so that it provides full-time jobs for all everyone that needs them.
Mm-hmm. Ben Honeycutt, some people listening are saying, I only wish I had as little as a 40-hour week, because
exactly.
We know the realities now are that people work 40 hours a week and more, two parents working 40 hours a week or more, And so we get to this term that I know you've talked about before, time famine.
Exactly. That is, makes the mystery even deeper. Why have we not only stopped shortening the hours of labor, why have we turned around? I think, Ben, that the Cadillac commercial, is this a time for?
Yes, this is a bit of audio that actually I brought to your attention.
Yes.
I was watching the latest Olympics, and this commercial came on, a fascinating spot. And knowing your work, I saw this commercial, and I said, I have to email this to Professor Honeycutt, because this is exactly what he's talking about, except it's the argument for a different idea of progress, I guess
exactly.
You would say. Here it is. We'll listen to the audio, but you have to have the pictures in mind, too. So we open up with a middle-aged white male standing in front of a luxurious pool in the backyard of his palatial residence. And in 60 seconds, he gives us this defense of one version of the American dream, strolling through his amazing house, strolls by his perfect wife, past his two perfect kids who are studying dutifully on the couch, and out to unplug his electric Cadillac. Let's listen to this.
Why do we work so hard? For what? For this? For stuff? Other countries, they work, they stroll home, they stop by the cafe, they take August off. Off. Why aren't you like that? Why aren't we like that? Because we're crazy, driven, hard-working believers, that's why. Those other countries think we're nuts. Whatever. Were the Wright brothers insane? Bill Gates, Les Paul, Ali. Were we nuts when we pointed to the moon? That's right. We went up there, you know what we got? Bored. So we left. Got a car up there, left the keys in it. Do you know why? Because we're the only ones going back up there, that's why. But I digress. It's pretty simple. You work hard, you create your own luck, and you gotta believe anything is possible. As for all the stuff, that's the upside of only taking 2 weeks off in August. Nespa?
Ben Honeycutt, what I love about this commercial, it's just such a crystallization of the American dream that you are not looking at in this book. You're looking at an alternative dream, but
right.
This is actually the dream that many of us are pursuing.
This is a dream that eclipses the older dream. The emergence of this idea, this belief. Notice in the commercial how he talks about belief. It's what I believe. It's fundamental. It's a religion. It's what this
right.
man has faith in. Hard work. Stuff, it's not important. It's just a byproduct. What's important is his faith. Faith is one of the great motivators of the human animal. Nothing else is as powerful.
And it unifies our identity, too. He says,
exactly.
Why aren't you like that?
Right.
When he disses, we assume, the Europeans strolling back to their families for some leisure time. And then he says, why aren't you like that? Why aren't we like that? We are a different tribe, he's saying.
We believe in something different. Our credo is very different from the Europeans, who are a bunch of lazy folks who believe in family or in their Christianity. What in the world are these people believing in? This man is a true believer. All other faiths fall short because they don't. It's not because they're not successful economically. It's a wrong belief. These are people who are believing in unreal things.
So this is really the American dream that has been driving us for decades now.
Exactly.
And the other forgotten dream that you write about in your book is on the sidelines, lived by some people.
I think it's still viable. I see it in a variety of places, in some of my students, in my children. It's still there. I think the dynamic in the economy is this faith, represented by the Cadillac commercial, is in a lot of ways, this is the book that I'm working on now, a failing faith. It does not really answer our humanity. The needs we have as human creatures for free, open contact, fellowship, not mediated by cash, the need to give, the need for charity, the need to share,
But these things can coexist and actually do coexist.
Well, they do. There's no the two belief systems, or
well, to be focused on, I guess, more material things, possessions,
yeah.
Working very hard, having more of an identity together with your work, but also being charitable, being community minded.
Absolutely, there's no. Disconnect between the two, and you know, absolutely, people who are committed to their jobs, and as I tell my class, God bless you. I hope you find a job that will be your passion. Chances are you're not. Chances are.
Why do you say that?
Well, the statistics will bear me out. The statistics are that most people find jobs. Most of our population don't have professional jobs that are challenging, rewarding in and for themselves. The most of our jobs are not Prince Charming jobs. Mm-hmm. They're good. But not an intrinsically rewarding experience.
Let me remind our listeners that my guest this hour is Benjamin Honeycutt, a historian and professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa. His latest book, Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, is something he's been working on for over 40 years to unravel a mystery about a certain period of our history when we were looking towards shorter working weeks, shorter working hours, and then that trend reversed to what we have today when many of us are working well over 40 hours a week and trying to make ends meet. I want to ask you about electronics because we have gone through a revolution in the last decade or two. Electronics and the internet, especially smartphones and other mobile devices. What have you seen that they've done to work?
I think to work itself. Well, it has, and
its connection with leisure time.
Well,
sure.
It goes both ways. I think the jury is still out about the devices that we're having. There's a promise and there's a threat. The threat is that the long arm of the job will continue to extend far beyond the workplace into our homes, into our cars, and so forth. So there's no escape. That we will be. Total work, a world where there's no reality except work.
24/7, we have our smartphone there, and we're available to those who demand that we be accessible 24/7.
Well, back to the Cadillac commercial, he talked about having 2 weeks. He's unusual. Most of us have less than 2 weeks on average. There's no guarantee even that 2 weeks, far behind the Europeans. But again, if electronics threaten this, I think the devices that we have, cell phones and so forth, so that it makes our lives, you know, one tone, one dimensional man. I'm not sure you remember that there's nothing in our lives except work. But on the other side, my students will tell me this that they are connecting on Facebook and so forth with a lot more people, and I think there's an upside to it, I must say.
Right, and you for many people, have a certain type of work that they can do some of it at home.
Exactly.
And some of it in an office when it previously only was to be done at an office. So we like that flexibility.
Exactly. It provides, that's the upside of the electronics, that it provides that flexibility that previously was not there. So I think, again, as I say, the jury is still out. It's up to us. I don't think there's any supernatural driver for how long we work. I think we choose, and we continue to make those choices. What I'd like to do simply is to point out to my students and people who would like to listen to me that there is a choice, and we can make those choices, and that we've got plenty of people telling you to buy this and that, Cadillacs and the whole deal, but very few people that represent the traditional American dream, that there's another product out there that has some traction to it, and that is Walt Whitman and this higher progress, time for family, time to live our lives freely in nature. And with the people around us.
I wanted to make sure we got to a little bit of a political stir that your book, but an article that you wrote for Politico magazine in February of 2014, it appeared with the headline, "Why Do Republicans Want Us to Work All the Time?" And you used the jumping off point of the Congressional Budget Office's estimation of what the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, would do to the workforce, 2.5 million less over the next decade was the judgment by the CBO. Now, you had some reaction to this article, which was essentially a concise look at what you the themes you deal with in your book.
Well, and no one looked at my book and my concise themes that I was at pains to write about in the Politico article. To tell you about a little about the article, they contacted me, Politico, and gave me 2 days to write this, and I'm not used to doing this sort of thing. Academics, I take years to write books and so forth. But I responded, and actually I wrote it on Friday morning and got it to them, and they kept sending me revisions in which they would put in zingers, politically charged words and ideas, and I would take them out. If you read the piece, it's bipartisan. It's milquetoast compared to a lot of stuff.
Except for the headline, which you did not write.
Which I did not write. I sent in the last, you know, the final version, no headline at all. My headline was Obamacare and the Forgotten American Dream. I thought that was what, but, you know, opened the paper or the internet the next day, and there's that headline that I had not written. And it stirred up a hornet's nest of people on the right.
What sort of reaction did you get?
Oh, it's vicious. It's not too soft, hard a word. I need a harder word to describe the reaction. But it wasn't, as I say, against in response to what I wrote. It was a response to the headline. And the only thing that the right, Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly all had a great time inventing what they would like for me to have said. They, in effect, what they said that I wrote, which I didn't, was that I thought no one should have a job. I was against work, and I wanted everyone to be on the public dole.
Here's a quote I have from Herman Cain from his website.
Oh, Lord.
Well, let's listen here. He writes, in a broader sense, yes, Mr. Professor of Leisure Studies. So there's
they had fun with that.
Yeah. Mr. Professor of Leisure Studies, it's better when people work more. When they work more, they earn more, the nation produces more, and we create more wealth, which is necessary, by the way, to pay for elements of our gigantic public sector that includes jobs like the Professor of Leisure Studies at the University of Iowa. Those are the words of Herman Cain. So there it is. That's the Cadillac commercial fighting
exactly,
back.
Exactly. Well, I would like very much to have had the opportunity to dialogue with people like Herman Cain and talk about half of the article, if you read it, in Politico that I wrote, was coming from conservative business people. Not half, maybe a third. People like Walter Gifford, the head of AT&T, Henry Ford. I quote Gifford in
– So you have captains of industry.
Exactly.
Previously in our history were for this alternative American dream.
And they thought, they were proud that the flower of capitalism, the great achievement of capitalism – it's why capitalism is so much better than socialism. Socialism promises us freedom. Capitalism delivers it with shorter hours. And they were talking about communism and socialism during this time and bragging that capitalism is the way in which ordinary workers would experience this substantial freedom from economic concerns by shortening the hours of labor. It's not only I can add a few more people. Elihu Root, one of my favorite Republicans of the early part of the 20th century, perhaps the most prominent conservative Republican of the 20th century, Elihu Root, writes about this. I can't quote exactly, but he said something like, the only significant thing that the machine does for us is to give us shorter hours. And he says that this leisure time, the great product of free market, would be the great challenge of education in the 20th century. I'd like to think of myself as a disciple of Elihu Root because I'm trying to teach in preparation for the coming of free time. So
we have just a couple minutes left, okay. And I'd like to get to some forward looking thoughts, as in future forward looking thoughts from you. Do you have any optimism that after reading your book, after discussing it with you, I can't say I have a lot of optimism that this trend towards longer working hours and more stress rather than less and more leisure is going to get turned around anytime soon. What are your hopes?
I'm both pessimistic and optimistic. Pessimistic in the sense that I'm not sure that my book is going to make, you know, much difference at all, or the people who are talking about the value of less work, short hours, and longer vacations, John DeGraff and his people, if we'll be able to make a much difference at all. But I am more optimistic about the marketplace, and this maybe will require another show, Ben, but I'm teaching a course now called The Experience Economy. According to some business experts, the coming thing that the market will have to evolve into is the experience economy, from the service economy, from manufacturing service. Now, the next big thing is experience, Disneyland, where experiences are going to be sold, marketed, and people will begin to demand experiences after having, you know, gotten past service, gotten past manufactured goods. That, to me, is promises great things. If, in fact, the marketers can begin to market superior experience products, time with the family,
right,
make opportunities for community. If the advertisers, if the experienced designers in the marketplace, I hope my students, I'm teaching my entrepreneurial students to do this, can learn to do this and sell these things, these experiences successfully, then the demand for free time ought to expand naturally through the marketplace.
We'll end this conversation with that hopeful prediction from Benjamin Honeycutt of the University of Iowa. His new book is titled Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. Ben Honeycutt, thanks for coming in today.
You're certainly welcome, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.